Welcome to Strong Tower Radio On Location. I'm in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I'm at the Michigan Tech Research Institute. And we are looking at a concern that many of you have had about smoke, wildfire smoke from Canada. But we're going to find out that there's multiple causes, and you'll find this to be a very interesting interview. Let's bow for a word of prayer, and we'll get into the interview. Our great Heavenly Father, we just appreciate who you are. You love your people, and you love the environment. You're sad when these tragedies happen, but we ask that the people that have been hurt or injured or have respiratory issues be with them and be with us as we do our interview. In Jesus' name, amen. I have with me Dr. Nancy French, and I also have Dr. Laura Bourgeau-Jabez, and they are researchers here at the Michigan Tech Research Institute. We have had smoke drift from Canada, and it's been a peak in activity. I'm going to ask Nancy to talk about this, Dr. Nancy French. Please explain, where is the smoke coming from and why is it so bad the last 3 years?
There's been more fire in Canada over the last few years, 2023 and 2025 this year. We've had quite a bit of fire in the northern and western parts of Canada. These areas that are burning are full of trees that are meant to burn. It's an ecologically important part of the system.
Meant to burn. It seems like forest fires are always to be prevented. You know, that's what Smokey said, right?
That's right. But in some types, they actually need the fire to be able to rejuvenate and become a more productive forest, a forest that's more healthy with a mosaic of different ages and things like that. And that's true of much of the Canadian forest.
So we closer to home, we think of the Kirtland warbler, kind of this special bird that nests and breeds in our area predominantly more than many other places, at least does the nesting here. And we hear about the jack pines. And how in order for that those jack pines, which they prosper in, they need to burn every so often to release the seeds to for that forest. Same thing?
Same thing. Different species, different parts of the ecosystem need different types of burns, light burns, heavy burns. We wouldn't have any aspen trees if we didn't have fires because they are what we call a pioneer species. They come in after the fires. And if we don't have enough fire, then we have just a monoculture of fire of forests that are old and not as healthy.
So we have to have a cross-section of this. You said the word mosaic.
That's right. And this isn't true everywhere. A lot of people's backyards are beech maple forest and things like that. That's a different type. But in much of the northern part where we're having fires right now, these are fire-adapted systems that burn periodically and make smoke. So that's why we have smoke.
And naturally, these fires happen naturally. In fact, if they don't, you have that monoculture. That means all the trees are the same age.
Yep, exactly.
It's just like a society. You need to have a variety of people at different ages. If everybody's in a certain age group, there's not a balance. And in the future, that will be a problem.
That's right. Diversity is very healthy, makes a place very healthy and a nice place to be, too, for us and any beings that need to use the place, the flora and fauna.
We're kind of looking at the history here. We've had fires the last 3 years that seem to have really perked up our attention. There's been 2023 was a high water mark, but this year came awfully close.
That's correct. There's been almost as much fire this year as 2023 in the areas of Canada where we're seeing this smoke coming from. And it's devastating to the communities up there as well as for people downwind that like us.
Now, there was another rash of them, and it was in 2014. Dr. Laura, could you talk about the 2014 fires?
So where I study in Northwest Territories, there was extreme drought and wildfire in 2014, just like there was again in 2023. And it for 3.4 million hectares across the landscape there. And it was devastating to communities. There's only one road north going to Yellowknife, and there were so many fires along that road they had to shut it down. And so the community in Yellowknife was stuck. They couldn't bring in planes or supplies, food, and the people there, as you can imagine, were traumatized by this. And they had to bring in psychologists and social workers to help them work through that. It was an entire summer of that. And then again in 2023, now they're evacuating faster or sooner, and again this year. But they keep getting evacuated now.
That gets old after a while.
Yes, yes.
It's like having tornado warnings every night.
And having to leave your home. Yeah, go somewhere else.
Or stay up all night and sleep in the basement or whatever.
Yeah, and then where do you go? You know, you're evacuated. You have to go somewhere out to another location that's safer. But the fires are hurrying all over the place. So it's very traumatic for them. 2023 was also traumatic to the point we wanted to talk to some of the communities, and they told us not to bring up the 2023 fires. It was so traumatic for them.
Wow.
Right.
Let's, we've talked about the history and the smoke. Let's talk about you a little bit, in the sense that what is your academic background and this institute? It's just amazing. This all, I need to give credit to the Michigan Bridge Magazine, the news service, Karen House. I've read a couple of her articles, The Whitefish, Decline, Collapse in the Harvest, which did a wonderful article, and I followed and did some research and phone calls related to this. But likewise with this Canadian smoke, I finally got answers.
Right.
And you were one of the people that was referenced, and so I did located you about through the internet. And I've heard about this institute. It's with Michigan. It's a arm or owned or by Michigan Technological University in Houghton, Michigan. But tell us a little about this history. What does this institute do? It's had some landmark sensing information, electronic, digital, satellite, visioning, and multiple applications. I was just amazed. We've heard about it before, but maybe it was in another form decades ago.
Right. So our history starts with Environmental Research Institute of the Michigan, which they were pioneers in all kinds of remote sensing, from LAMSAT and radars. They just pioneered all of the development of what kind of people know about, like INSAR, which is using radar to get at digital elevation. They were pioneers in that as well. And they, at some point, broke up into different units. The group that we are now, had a lot of us from Heritage IRM, and it was purchased by Michigan Tech in 2006. They wanted a presence and one research facility in the Lower Peninsula. And so that's how that came to be.
Tell our listening audience, we've heard the term Landsat, but how has it touched their lives indirectly that they may not know? What do they have today that wouldn't be here without the research that has been done here?
Okay. It helps a lot with all of the remote sensing. I guess a good one is understanding the climate and understanding weather patterns. They might see that with, both the land radars, but also systems that monitor hurricanes and other weather patterns. That's something that directly affects them. Some of the other research that's done is maybe not as obvious. So a lot of this stuff I do is with wetlands, and we will map using Landsat and radar. Map where an invasive plant, Phragmites, is, for example.
And explain that particular one you were explaining to me, how it impacts people here in Michigan.
Right. So we've worked on mapping it across the whole Great Lakes Basin for the USGS at some point, because it's become very problematic. It can grow very tall, up to 15 feet tall, and it's dense, and it outcompetes all of the native vegetation. So you don't have the habitat for wildlife, for ducks and birds.
For sure, birds in shallow areas.
Because it's too dense, the fish can't get into it either. And then it reduces recreation for people, and it's not pleasant to look at. In Saginaw Bay, where we've been doing a lot of work with that community, the CISMA there, the Coordinated Invasive Species Management Area in Saginaw Bay, we've been working with them directly for a little over 10 years, getting grants, and we have developed some protocols for mapping so that we know where it is, and then also sampling in the field, as well as mapping again after treatments, which are typically herbaceous treatments in the fall when the plants are going dormant so that the chemical goes into the roots and kills it. And so then we monitor it and we see the seed bank, native seed bank coming back. And we've cleared about 12 miles of shoreline there in Saginaw Bay.
Basically reclaimed 12 miles of lakeshore vistas and access to the water.
Right. It's so dense and it would cover like a half a mile into the water.
Half a mile.
And very, very dense. And you couldn't get through it. You couldn't access the water. There were kids that grew up there, didn't know that they lived next to a great lake. So now they have access to it. So that part of our work is very rewarding. And we use those satellites in order to map it. It's used for a whole lot of different applications like that.
Landsat, that was a satellite-based photographic information?
Right. It's in the visible spectrum, and infrared is what it measures. It has 8 bands. Nancy's actually an expert on Landsat. I'm more of a radar person. So
radar is more land-based?
No, there's satellites with radar. And it actually is what helped us also to help map that invasive plant, because it's sensitive to biomass. So that higher biomass of that plant is distinct from
other. It has its own fingerprints.
It does. And then it also, the radar penetrates the canopy so that you can actually see the water underneath. So we can see that it's a wetland, and then we can see the high biomass.
So you know where the shore is.
Yep.
Before that, it's like somewhere in here in that half mile range. Makes me, and I shared this, I asked earlier before we recorded, if you've ever been in Florida and you see the mangroves and you've been on the water, you can't figure out where the beach is.
Right.
Because it grows out, and this is but it's a foreign invasive species.
Right, it's European. So there's a native Phragmites in Michigan in the Great Lakes. It does not create these monocultures. It doesn't grow outcompete other vegetation, doesn't grow 15 feet tall. It coexists with other wetland plants, but the non-native is European. It's mostly in places where there's high levels of nitrogen. So
near farmlands and
farmlands and golf courses. And so you don't really see it too far north, although it is starting to be in the Upper Peninsula as well. But typically, it's very heavy down in Lake Erie, Lake St. Clair, Lake Huron. You'll see it if you drive to Chicago down 94 all along the road, and you'll think, "What is this plant?" Because it's so big, it looks like it's kind of attacking the highway.
Yes, wow. What is your background? What brought you to where you are today academically?
So I studied forest ecology at the University of Michigan as my undergrad, and I began at Irem shortly after that. I was hired because of that background, but on day one, I was learning how to process a radar image, which was totally new to me, and I just developed what we call radar eyes. I can use the radar for all kinds of applications.
Just like when we go for a medical test, do you have somebody who reads with those x-rays?
Right.
You're the x-ray reader.
Yep, I'm the radar girl.
This is what you're seeing is this.
Right.
Very good. Thank you so much, Dr. Laura. Dr. Nancy, tell us a little bit about your expertise and here at the Institute.
Sure. My undergraduate degree is from a small college in Maine, Bates College, in physics. I learned that physics was very interesting, but wasn't really what I wanted to do in life. And then I learned there was this thing called ecology and got my master's degree in ecology from the University of Michigan. At that same time, I started working at Irem, got the radar eyes that Laura just mentioned. With my physics background, which wasn't super strong, but I had a lot of knowledge in some of the fundamentals of what remote sensing does. And then my passion was really in the ecological application of that. And then I got my PhD as well from the University of Michigan in ecology. So over the years, I've looked at different ways of using remote sensing, we call it. It's satellites and other ways of seeing the landscape with Landsat and synthetic aperture radar. There's LIDAR. There's many different ways that we call modalities that go into the mix of understanding to let us understand things like wetlands and smoke and the forest that's burning and things like that.
Let's go back to the Canadian wildfires. In years past, we talked about the Western wildfires, and Dr. Laura, you brought up something that your counterparts or the forestry, Canada Forestry, brought up. It's a two-way street. The wind blows both directions.
It does. So I know they heard
us complaining.
Yes, they heard us complaining about smoke in the east coming down from Canada. And a good colleague of mine said, no one ever talks about the smoke going north into Canada from the western fires. So it is reciprocal, and wherever way the wind's blowing. And we have fires, too, and that are extensive and causing problems for them.
When we have these fires, what is the current situation? What caused this spike in the wildfires? And we're only paying attention to it because it's irritating us.
Right. So long-term, drying drought from increased temperatures. I mean, it's getting warmer further north, and that is causing us Nancy was bringing up, this is happening everywhere, not just in Canada, but globally. We're having an increase in temperatures, and it's resulting in drying in many places. Some places you see flooding, so we're seeing more extremes. We're seeing extreme drought, and then we're seeing extreme flooding. And so the results of that are the landscape is so dry that a lot of these fires are started by lightning strikes. And
not even with human interaction. We're down here in the populated areas. The forestry people in Michigan say that more than half, maybe even three quarters of the fires are human cause.
Right.
But this is a total different
form. There aren't very many people where a lot of these fires are burning.
How many people are we talking about?
I dropped up. I don't have a number for you, but very small population. Vast areas of wilderness with these flammable black spruce, and they do have jack pine there too, that are also very flammable. But single roads going through this vast area, they're just not accessible, and they're getting primarily started by lightning strikes. In the more populated areas, I think it is probably more common for it to be human cause. It could be a spark from your car or a cigarette out the window or campfire getting away.
Or burning, just plain brush burning. And
right. Yep, those things. But they're primarily lightning ignitions, and it's because it's so dry, and those black spruce and jack pine are very flammable. We started a campfire with a live black spruce branch before. It's got resins in it that are very flammable.
Even if it's green and it's got some foliage on it.
Right.
Wow.
So they're very adapted to fire. Their cones stay closed until the heat of the fire opens them up, and then you let the seeds out. So they're adapted to regenerating after fire.
Dr. Nancy, when we, in the summertime, when it rains, if it's the temperature above 70, nearing 80, you could go out and on the pavement and see it evaporate within an hour or so. The pavement's dry. I observed that just recently. So what is that formula with temperature, how with evaporation? If you're in the 40s, you evaporate at a certain rate. If you're at 80.
Yep, that's right. When it's hotter, you have a higher evaporation potential. I'm not a meteorologist, so I won't go too deep into it. But the heat, the warmer conditions cause two different things, both just what we call evapotranspiration. It's both the evaporation and the trees doing their thing, transpiring. So the amount of liquid that's on the ground, in the surface, goes into the air more because it's warmer. So that just dries things out. And then the heat, it's warmer. So you know this from lighting your campfire. If you go camping and it's cold out, even if it's dry, it's harder to get that going than it is if it's in the 50s and you're trying to get a fire versus if it's in the 70s. You can light your fire a lot faster in the 70s because it takes less time for it to get hot enough. So that's just, like I said, I'm not a meteorologist, but it's both dryness and the heat that cause fires to become more energetic and then more fuel consumption and then more smoke. It's pretty basic. Some of those nuances of what causes more smoke or smoke to go aloft higher, that's where our research is looking at now. My work working with meteorologists and others that are experts in fire behavior.
Does the, air mass that goes through, I'm trying to think of the word.
The jet stream?
Jet stream.
Yes. I think, again, not a meteorologist, but we were talking about why some smoke's coming from Canada now, and sometimes we'll get smoke from the Western fires. In past years, I think we more often got that. That's related to those prevailing winds, we might call them, and just the way the wind blows. Is it going up to Canada or is it coming to us? Or is it going to people's houses that are nearby? That it's a very complex situation. When you have fire, the smoke can really do just about anything. Does it go high or is it down low? And some of the experience people have probably had it this summer was sometimes you actually smell the smoke. It's coming down and you can look at your Air Now app and see that you probably shouldn't be outside doing things because the air quality is poor. But other times it was way up there and we just saw like a haze for several days and we didn't necessarily have poor air quality. What causes that separation, where it goes, high or low, is very, very complex. Again, not my specialty, but something that there's a lot of research looking at why that happens and how we can predict it, because that's the most important thing. We want to know when we need to take care of it.
Is there anything that we can stop it, or is it something that we should let burn? You said this is part of that ecological regeneration, the generations, and diversifying that monoculture?
Yeah. Well, it depends on the ecosystem. We know a lot of the Western U.S. and Canada are fire prone, so we need to live with it. And so we need to, in a way, work with fire to make fire better. There's a lot of effort to put more prescribed fire on the land. In fact, the state of California has a mandate to do more prescribed fire. I was involved with a study with the California Department of Public Health where we looked at that question into the future. If you have more prescribed fire, does that mean more smoke in the air compared to if you had just the wildfires happening?
Now, or do you have it later?
That's right. And that's pretty much what we know. The question is, how much does that affect a person? So this study actually did what we call an epidemiological study, looking at how people are intersecting with that. And the answer was that there will be more smoke with more prescribed fire, but it'll be much, much lower concentrations. And then the question is, these are things we don't know precisely. If you have more smoke at less concentration, is that better than one, shot at once with a lot of concentration? We don't know the answer to that. But most likely, it's going to affect more people at a lower level if we have prescribed fire instead of wildfires. That's what this study showed. These are a lot of this is research. A lot of it is kind of, we know that smoke can be hard to live with. But is it so bad if we have it more often at a lower concentration? We don't know. Anyway, a lot of it's research science we're working on, and I love doing it myself. So,
what do you think? Did you have any idea when you'll have some answers, or is it pretty open ended?
Well, we'll have some answers soon. If you think about let's think for a minute about predicting smoke, where it's going to be. Just a few years ago, we couldn't go on to the Weather Channel and have them tell us if we're going to have smoke there, because we weren't doing that. Smoke models weren't very mature. They weren't integrated with the weather models.
We had precipitation models, but not smoke.
Correct. And you remember, I'm old enough to remember when I was a kid, you'd get a forecast for 3 days from now or a week from now on whether it's going to rain. And you kind of believed it. You kind of didn't because it was the weather, right? Nowadays, we can look 10 days into the future and have a pretty good idea. And 3 days, almost no problem. We know if it's going to rain 3 days from now, pretty much a lot better than when I was a kid.
We're to the point where we say we look at by hour.
That's right.
And we actually change our behavior.
Exactly. And so what we have now is smoke modeling that's like it was when I was a kid. Okay, we're just starting to really know how to do that. And I would say in very short time, we're going to have a much better way of knowing where the smoke is going to be, what its concentration is. And some of the research will tell us, you know, do you really have to stop running when it's at this level? Like, where is it for me? There's a lot of individual decisions that are made related to that. So a lot of the research that I know of and that I'm involved with will help us a little bit making those decisions.
Would seem like that the information gained from the precipitation maps can be transferred over and it just needs to be applied and stuff.
And that's exactly what's happening. The National Weather Service and NOAA, colleagues of mine that are with NOAA, are building new models that are integrated with weather models. So they're all one model, really. It's all one predictive way of understanding where the different components are. Where's the wind and where's the rain and where's the smoke?
Well, I think you've cleared some of the smoke with this interview. You know, it would really somewhat caught us by surprise into just to learn that some of this, it's not marketable timber in this particular area. Some of it has to happen. It's got to be either sooner or later. You can have it all at once, or it could be gradual over a period of time. It is natural, not human, at least these fires are. We have much to learn. What if our listeners' interest has been piqued by this conversation and experiencing the smoke wildfires over the last 3 years? How can they, what's the next step for that? Where can they go?
Well, they can go to our website and see what we're working on at mtri.org. They can look at some of the apps, like Nancy mentioned, the Air Now app, that would tell them where the smoke is. There's the other one that we were using when we were using it constantly. I was just in Canada and the fires were affecting us. We were out sampling the effects of the 2023 fires, and we would use the Air Now app, and then there's another one called Fire Smoke. And so using those, it does a little bit of forecasting of where the smoke is going. And that was really helpful when we were in the field. So we would know we need to bring our N95 masks out today and wear them in the car and wear them when we were out in the field. And then the next day, the wind would shift and we would be fine. It's good to have those sources to look at.
Well, I want to thank you both, Dr. Nancy French and Dr. Laura
Orgel-Chavez.
It's been a pleasure, and to know that there are researchers that are looking at it, that there are people that are tasked to do this, and you're producing results that will affect our lives and at least we'll know what's happening, and maybe like with the invasive species, things can be done about that.
Right. Yes,
that's right.
I just want to thank you again for Strong Tower Radio on Location. I'm Tom Majeure in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Until next time, bye now.